Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. My name is Rob Doster. It is Thursday, December 14th. We've got a good show on tap for you today. Spend some time with Greg McDermott, the head coach of the Creighton Blue Jays, talking about how his style of play has changed over the last 15 years from a team that was more of a pack line, slow it down team when he was at Northern Iowa to this up-tempo run and gun, spread the floor, bomb threes, pick and roll team that we see now with the Creighton Blue Jays. I also have my guy Sam Vecini from The Athletic and the Game Theory podcast. He came on to talk about some of the games that are coming up this weekend and the betting lines that we do like. And as always, please rate the podcast, review the podcast, subscribe to the podcast, whether you're an Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere that you can get these podcasts for free. If you can interact with them, it does help within the metrics of those apps. It makes my bosses happy, which in turn makes me happy because I'm not getting yelled at by the infamous podcast producer, Tess Quinlan. So please help keep me happy, keep me from getting yelled at by my bosses, and enjoy the show that we have on tap for you today. Let's get into that interview with Greg McDermott. Now I'm pleased to welcome on the head coach of the Creighton Blue Jays, straight out of Omaha, somewhere in middle America, Greg McDermott. Coach, let me start you with this. This is your eighth year with the program. How long did it take for you to get sick of people quoting that Counting Crows song when they talk to you about the town that you're working in?
That didn't take me very long. I'm a Midwest boy at heart, so I've spent really my entire career in the Midwest and the upper Midwest, so you know, Omaha's a big city for me.
Are you at least a Counting Crows fan?
Not really.
Yeah, I wasn't either. I actually saw them once at a concert in high school because a girl that I had a crush on was a big fan of them, but she ended up breaking my heart, so...
That should have told you something right there, Rob.
Yeah, it did. I moved on quickly, though, and I bounced back. But I didn't bring you on to talk music. I brought you on to talk hoops. Before we get into this team that you have, you obviously have a son playing in the NBA right now. Considering what your schedule is, how often do you actually have a chance to see him play and watch his games? And do you even get a chance to see him play in person?
I was out there just this past Sunday. I was in New York. We had an off day, so I snuck out there and spent a day and a half with him because I obviously won't see him at Christmas time. But I've probably been to three or four. That's including some preseason games. But you know, every once in a while, I'll jump on the iPad late at night and catch part of his games on replay. But obviously, he's really busy, and it's a busy time of the year for me. But having spent a couple of days with him in New York, he's very excited to be there. He really likes the team and Coach Hornacek and his staff. So it appears to be a good fit for him. And, hopefully it's something that'll be, more than a short-term deal.
So you haven't started scheduling your recruiting trips to be in the same city that his teams are playing?
No, that's pretty hard to do, really hard to do. And, it's just while I enjoy watching him play, it is his job. He's very extremely busy, as you can imagine, an NBA schedule and what all goes into that. But it's certainly been fun to follow his progress and watch his development as he continues to kind of navigate a path through that league.
So Doug, to me, is the perfect example to use when we talk about just how good NBA basketball players actually are, because I don't think people really realize that. Here's a guy who put together one of the most productive careers that we've ever seen in college basketball. He averaged 26 points in the Big East. I would argue there probably aren't 250 people in the world that are better than he is at his profession. And yet in the NBA, he's basically a role player, a floor spacer, a guy getting 20 minutes a game, 25 minutes a game. That's on his third team in 4 years. And at the level that you're coaching at now in the Big East with Creighton, in and around the top 25 just about every year, you're working with guys that all have kind of those NBA hoop dreams. So for you, how hard is it to manage some of those expectations and to try to, maybe deliver a little bit of a dose of reality without trying to crush somebody's dreams? Because it's not easy to make it where he is in the NBA.
No, certainly we talk to our guys about, what the numbers say. The odds of making it in the NBA are certainly small, but at the same time, I'm not going to crush anybody's dream either. My job is to try to make them as good a college basketball player as we possibly can in the time that they're here and try to develop them to their fullest potential. And then, it's somebody else's decision on whether they can play in the NBA or not. And Doug certainly had an unbelievable college career, and when he got to, I think when you come from high school to college, I think you have to change your game. I think there are things that worked in high school that don't necessarily work in college. You have to change parts of your game. You have to add to it. And I think unless you're an elite level athlete and maybe in the, that top 2 or 3% of guys that are in the NBA, I think once you get to the NBA from college basketball, you have to make some changes. And if you go back and look at Doug's game as a senior in college to where it is today, he's added a lot of things to his game, and he's changed his game to try to survive at that level. And it's really hard. I mean, I've sat close and watched some games. I know you have too. I mean, the length and the size and the strength of the guys that are on the floor. I mean, nothing really comes easy. And, so you have to work for everything you get. And, but it's, we want guys to aspire to play at that level, certainly. And, we've been fortunate that we've had a few, and I think we'll have a couple more here the next couple of years.
So one of the reasons that I do have you on here is because I think that the change in what you're, at least from the outside, what your coaching philosophy is and the way that your teams have played now versus, the teams that you had with North Dakota State and with Northern Iowa, I think it's interesting to see that difference. But before we get into that, do you actually, when you look at what you're doing now with your team and what you did with Northern Iowa 10 or 15 years ago, do you really see a difference in your philosophy?
Certainly in the offensive philosophy, we've changed. I think what we're attempting to do defensively, I think some of the fundamental teaching parts of our defense are the same. Now, while I say that, the game has changed. I remember at Northern Iowa, my first 2 or 3 years, you might defend, 10 ball screens the entire game, but you're going to defend a staggered double. You're going to defend a double screen. You're going to defend America's play, the screen, the screener. I mean, over and over and over again. And the game has changed, where now you may defend those actions, 6 to 10 times a game, and you're defending ball screens really every possession. So I think defensively you better change with the game because the game is changing. But offensively, we've certainly, we're much more up-tempo, and part of it was the personnel we had early in Doug's career. And during that time, in our first year, we played in the CBI, I think, at the end of the year, and the Davidson team came in here. And, I was so impressed with the pace and speed that they played with. And I just thought Coach McKillop did an unbelievable job of putting pressure on your defense every single time. And as I looked at their team, while they were good athletes, they weren't elite athletes. Yet they were able to put pressure on you in transition on a made shot, on a missed shot. It didn't make any difference. You had to get back. You had to get turned around, and you had to be ready to defend action right away. And that really intrigued me. And as a result, we made some changes to what we do offensively, and now we've recruited to it. So, once you make that change and it works, obviously it's an attractive system for young guys to play.
Do you think you would have been able to have this kind of success with it if you didn't have a guy like Doug on your roster? I mean, when you talk about small ball, he's kind of the prototype college small ball four that you can use.
Well, he's perfect for it because, number one, he can run. And when he was playing for us, he was shot out of a cannon a lot when we went from defense to offense because he knew he could steal a couple baskets a game by outrunning the defense. But, he was certainly a great starting point. But, we had some skilled guys that, as I look back, Austin Chapman, Johannes Maniga, Grant Gibbs, are any of those guys, Ethan Rogge was a 6'6", 6'7", probably should have been just a pick and pop four that we played at the five. But they were guys that could handle it, could pass it, could make good decisions, and they could all shoot it. And Doug was the guy who would score in the block with that team. So, we would spread out the floor and transition and really attack. But we had guys that were skilled enough to play that way. And if you're going to play fast, you have to have a level of decision-making and skill. Otherwise it's going to look like a train wreck. So, Doug was certainly the perfect starting point for us. And then you add guys like Justin Patton down the road, that fit extremely well in that system of play.
So I had a chance to catch up with Grant last week, and he was actually the guy that kind of planted the idea for the story in my head. And he specifically remembers the prep for that 2011 CBI. And what I'm curious about is when you were he said that in practice, you started letting people, you know, get out and run, and you wanted to space the floor, set ball screens, fire up threes. Were you testing things out to see what you had in the future because you saw that kind of potential with the guys you had in your roster, or was that kind of a way for you, you know, you're going to the CBI, it's not the most glamorous tournament. Were you trying to find a fun way to kind of keep some of those seniors engaged and focused on this group?
I think it was a combination of it, Rob. I think we had if I'm not mistaken, a 7 or 8 day prep in between. And as you can imagine, you know, we had some seniors that I only coached for 1 year. They played for Coach Altman and they bought into what we were doing in an unbelievable way. But, you know, their goals and aspirations for the end of their senior season weren't to play in the CBI. So we wanted to be creative and we wanted to make practice fun in preparation for that. At the same time, we had, you know, Grant was sitting out. I believe Ethan was coming off an injury and was sitting out. We were able to, you know, run some guys out there that maybe hadn't played together all year because Grant was on the scout team and just see what it looked like. And at the time, Antoine Young was our point guard. And, you know, Antoine was really good in transition, really good in space at attacking the rim and was able to make good decisions. So it just kind of evolved after that. We kind of liked it as a coaching staff, and we sensed that our guys were enjoying that. And then you add to it, you play Davidson and you see how successful they are and maybe aren't the most athletic team that in their league, yet they're successful in scoring points because they do it every time. And that's really the key to playing fast. Every young player says they want to play fast until you make them play fast. I mean, it is hard to run the court every time and then, you know, be responsible for everything else you're supposed to do defensively and in communication. But once you get guys to do it, it works. And I think it's been great for us.
And it's fun to play that way, too. You can get out and run. Guys enjoy it. It's got to be easier to convince someone to come play and say, hey, you're going to be able to, you know, get up 5 or 6 threes a game than maybe play like a 55-possession game.
Yeah, you know, guys understand if you're playing fast, there's more opportunities, obviously more possessions, more shots to be had. And, you know, and one thing that was probably the hardest for me, you know, when I was at Northern Iowa, our teams did not turn it over. And when you play fast, you have to take a step back and understand that if you want guys to be on the attack all the time, there's going to be a few more mistakes, and yet you have to live with a few more of those and understand that if you want them to have the foot on the gas pedal all the time, there's probably going to be a few more turnovers. But as long as our percentage of turnovers per possession isn't any higher than it was before, every analytic that I looked at certainly, you know, proved to me that this was the best way for us to play.
Did you bounce these kind of ideas off of anybody? You know, it's not easy for a coach to kind of change what he does this far into his career the way that you have. Did you talk to anyone about a new way to play, or was this just kind of the thing?
It really happened pretty fast during that week in preparation of making the change. And like I said, part of it was we wanted to keep it fun for the guys. And it kind of became a senior, you know, the senior class of, I think it was Caleb Korver and Kenny Lawson. And there was four Wayne Runnels. There was four or five of those guys, and it kind of became them against the rest of the guys in practice. And it was entertaining and it was fun. I think the guys enjoyed it. We certainly talked a lot about it as a staff, and then it was just really dumb luck that we ended up playing Davidson in a home game. And after that game, you know, we really studied what they did as a staff and their spacing in transition, and then we just kind of built it from there.
Let's pretend that it is 2002 right now and I'm talking to you. You're still at Northern Iowa, and I tell you that in 15 years, the two of the best teams that you will have coached, one will have, as you mentioned, 6'7" Ethan Rogge at center, and I don't know how many people listening to this realize, but he was a guy whose two skills on a basketball court were bombing 30-footers and growing great lumberjack beards. And then the other one was last year with Mo Watson, and you probably had maybe arguably the fastest team of any team in college basketball. If I would have told you that all those things were true, would you have believed me back in 2002?
Probably not. You know, but because how do you know where the game's going to go? I would have never – guess that the game is to where it's at in terms of, you know, how many ball screens are part of the game. If you go watch some of the old NBA games with, you know, Lakers, Celtics, I mean, there's no ball screens. They don't exist hardly. So it's just amazing how it's changed. But, you know, as a coach, you have to do what you can to give your team the best chance to win. And at Northern Iowa, you know, while I had really good teams, you know, we went to 3 straight NCAA tournaments, and those teams were so disciplined, and not just defensively in their positioning and what they did on that end of the floor and rebounding, but offensively, we took really good shots. We didn't turn it over. And while we weren't the most talented team maybe in the Missouri Valley Conference at that time, I think we were very efficient. And because we weren't the most talented, we didn't want more possessions. We wanted less possessions. And, you know, I think it's a coach's job to give your team the best chance to win. And at Northern Iowa, that's what I felt our best chance was, given our personnel. And now that we've been able to build the program at Creighton, really with this mantra of, you know, fly it up and down and let that thing fly, you know, we've been able to attract guys that really fit into this system and style of play.
Now, I spoke with Ben Jacobson, who was your assistant for 6 years, I want to say, and you coached him when you were at North Dakota. You guys both were there with Rich Glass, and he was saying that Rich Glass was a guy that kind of mentored you a little bit, I guess, when you were coming up absolutely. As a young coach. When he sees the way that you're playing now versus the way that you coached before, what was his reaction?
Coach Glass?
Yes.
Yeah, he was down here about a month ago. I asked him to come down. He just retired this year, and I want him to spend a couple of days and watch us practice. And, you know, some of the fundamental things that we do are things I learned from him. And really the only thing that's changed is the pace of the game. And, you know, the fact that, you know, we'll take a one-pass shot in transition if it's an open shot. And sometimes when I was coaching with him, you know, we wanted the ball to touch the paint. We wanted an inside touch because we had an All-American center. So, you know, it's based on personnel. But, you know, Jake hasn't really changed. You know, he's coaching very similar at Northern Iowa to how we did when we were there together. And part of it is what you're able to attract in recruiting. You know, would Jake be able to recruit the guys that could play at this pace located in Cedar Falls, Iowa? It's a little trickier. You know, since we've moved to the Big East and been able to recruit nationally, I think we've been able to find guys that fit this system a little bit better. But, you know, what I think is a great thing about college basketball and basketball in general, there are so many ways to do it. There's so many ways to be successful. You know, Ben Jacobson's one of the best college basketball coaches in the country, and he does it totally different than I do right now. But it works for him, and it works for their program, and you know, they're off to a great start again this year.
So the other interesting thing that Ben told me was I didn't realize when you took over that Northern Iowa program that it was coming off a 7-24 season. I didn't realize that they had only been to one NCAA tournament, I think, in the history of the program, at least since it's been a Division I team. And you, within 3 years, had them in the NCAA tournament, and within 5 years, had them in the third straight NCAA tournament with the second straight at-large bid. And what Ben said, which was kind of enlightening, was that he doesn't think that there's any coach in the country that could have rebuilt that program as quickly and to the degree that you did. So just kind of take me through that process of, I guess, turning a Northern Iowa program from something that wasn't really there into something that I think everybody kind of recognizes at this point as one of the best mid-major programs in the country.
Well, the first thing you have to do when you take over a program that hadn't been successful is you have to have buy-in from the leadership in that program. And, you know, we had some seniors on that first team I think we were 14 and 15, but, you know, we beat Iowa that year, who was ranked 8th in the country. Coach Alford had Luke Recker and, you know, had really good, Reggie Evans had a great team. But, you know, we had Robbie Sieverding, who's now the head coach at University of Dubuque. Andy Woodley was a senior. Eric Smith, you know, Trey Austin, who's coaching down in Houston. You know, those guys bought into what we were doing. And then the young people that were in our program were able to kind of follow their lead. And then you get lucky with some recruiting. You know, Ben Jacobson, the player, ended up having a great career for us. Eric Crawford transferred back from Bowling Green. He was from Minneapolis, and Eric's now on Ben's staff at Northern Iowa. But, you know, we had some really, really good players at an undersized center in David Gruber. Matt Schneiderman was a Division II transfer, 6'7", 6'8", could really shoot it as a stretch four. And then Brooks McCown, who's the all-time leading scorer in the history of the state of Iowa, you know, commits to us and comes and plays the point guard position. So, you know, we just had a group of guys that were really unselfish. They played together. They played hard. They kind of bought into this, you know, nobody thinks we can win, us against the world attitude. And we gradually saw ourselves getting better. Even the second year, we kind of took a step back, and I think we only won 13 games or 12 games. But we knew we were about to turn the corner, and when you can put a group together like that that believes in each other, and I had a great coaching staff, and certainly, you know, Ben was my right-hand man at that time. You know, we were able to get it turned around pretty quickly, and, you know, you beat a team like Iowa. We beat Iowa State on the road when they were ranked. We went to LSU and won at LSU the year they went to the Final Four. So you do things like that, and guys all of a sudden have a belief in themselves and in their teammates and in the program that maybe that didn't exist before. And then once you get guys to have that kind of belief and that kind of confidence, then I think anything's possible.
Do you think it's easier for a team at that level, at Northern Iowa's level, to win games against power conference programs, to go into LSU and get a win, to go into Iowa State and get a win, playing the style that you played there and that Ben's playing there now? Or do you think that if you had been playing this kind of up-tempo, spread it out, fire up threes, ball screen style back then, you would have had as much success?
I mean, it's hard to say. The team that I had at Northern Iowa, I'm not sure this style of play would have fit them the best. You know, we ran a lot of sets, and we were huge on execution and the timing and spacing and accuracy of those sets. You know, there were flare screens, there were back screens, there were slips, you name it, we did it. And the guys, you know, they had to have a pretty high IQ to run all that stuff and also a good understanding of what was going on to execute it. But the reality of it is, even in high school and AAU at that time, you know, the game was different. It wasn't ball screens. It wasn't space. It was, you know, you like I said, you came off staggered double screens. You understood how to read a flare screen. You know, you understood how to defend a back screen. I mean, you don't see it as much anymore, and they don't grow up with it. You know, they grow up, you know, watching a guy in a ball screen and make a play out of it. So, you know, and now that I've been at the BCS/Power 5 level now, you know, with my time at Iowa State and now here in the Big East, it's obviously a little more difficult to get a team ready to play. You know, no matter how much you tell a team how good Northern Iowa or Indiana State or Missouri State or whoever they're coming to play you, they don't take it as seriously as you need to, probably. So you have a chance maybe to knock some people off because they assume they can just show up and beat you. And when you have a team that knows how to play, like those teams at Northern Iowa did, you know, we had a lot of opportunities to go ahead and beat some pretty good teams.
So back in June, Ohio State made an effort to get you to be the guy to replace Thad Matta. How far did those discussions actually go? And what was it about Creighton that made you decide that a job that many people consider one of the maybe like 12 to 15 best in college basketball wasn't the right one for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to get into how far it went. Obviously, we had conversations and those have been well publicized. But, you know, the bottom line is I'm 53 years old. I really like my life. I like pulling into my driveway at night when I get home, and I like pulling into work every morning. I enjoy the people I work with. I think the administration here, with the upgrades we've made in our facilities, you know, the last 3 or 4 years, the way we travel, you know, our home venue and our attendance, which is consistently in the top 5 or 6 in the country, there was really nothing missing in my life. And I've never really made decisions in my life based on money in the past. I've made it because I thought it was a good move for me professionally or for our family. And had I chosen to leave, it strictly would have been because there have been more dollars involved. And I don't feel like that's the right reason to make a decision. And you know, I'm happy. My family's happy right where we're at. And we think we can do some special things here at Creighton. So I really didn't have any interest in leaving.
All right, so I'll leave you with this. If you were producing the remake of the movie White Men Can't Jump, would you cast Mitchell Ballack or Grant Gibbs in the Woody Harrelson role?
I mean, you could go with either one, but as you know, Mitch isn't a great athlete, but he looks great compared to Grant Gibbs, is what I would say athletically. those are two pretty good guys to choose from. Obviously, Grant had an incredible career here, and you know, was really a catalyst. you know, for our program changing the way we're viewed nationally. And now, you know, Mitch is, we're going to have a great 4 years with that guy because he's really a talented young man.
Coach, I appreciate the time. Thank you for hopping on.
You bet, Rob, anytime.
And now let me welcome on Sam Vecini, a friend of the podcast. He has his own podcast, the Game Theory Podcast. He writes for The Athletic, and he's going to help me work through some of these games and some of these betting lines that we have this weekend. Sam, what's going on, man? How you doing?
I'm all right, man. Just another day out here in L.A. It's sunny, it's beautiful, and I'm ready to get some paper, man. Put it this way, we might not have the best picks, but I can just about guarantee you that if we end up losing you money, I will have also lost money. So, you know, you can take these at heart and say, like, you know what? He's at least trying and putting his money where his mouth is.
All right. So just a quick note. We tell you this every week. The lines that we are using are going to be the lines that are projected on KenPom right now. We are recording this on a Thursday afternoon. There are no betting lines available yet for the games on Saturday or Sunday, but we want to talk to you a little bit about it. And the KenPom projections normally end up being pretty closely aligned with what Vegas has to say. So, Sam, let's start with the big game of the weekend, North Carolina at Tennessee. KenPom is saying that North Carolina is going to win by 1 point. What is your take?
That's a really hard one. That one, I think, could go either way. I'll probably take North Carolina, and just given how big the North Carolina fan base is, I would bet that line ends up being more like 2 or 3. For North Carolina, I'm still going to take the Tar Heels. I really do like this Tennessee team. And I was out with The Ringer and One Shining Podcast, Tate Frazier, last weekend. And he was like, I think that North Carolina is going to lose to Tennessee. I don't think so. Like, I've been high on this Tennessee team all year. They're really, really good defensively. They're a lot of the things that I like about basketball teams. They're small, they're fast, they're aggressive defensively. At the end of the day, though, I just think this North Carolina team's a lot better. Joel Berry is starting to get his feet back under him a little bit. You know, Luke May is a National Player of the Year candidate, and that's only like a 50% joke. So I just like North Carolina a little bit better. I understand that it's a road game and it's going to be tough in Knoxville, but I think I'm going North Carolina.
You know, I think I would probably lean that way as well. My take on North Carolina, on Tennessee at this point is that they are punching a little bit above their weight. I do like them, but I do think that they are, this is going to sound mean, but it's the truth. I do think that they kind of are like a bunch of tryhards that aren't quite as talented as some of the other guys on programs that are top 25 programs. And that they kind of get by because they're going to out-defend you. They're going to out-effort you. They're going to out-tough you. They're going to be more physical than you. So I think that North Carolina, in theory, should be able to go in there and get a win.
So can I give you a case the other way, though?
Yeah, hit me with it.
Isn't North Carolina kind of like that this year? Like for a North Carolina team, at least. Like, this is kind of a try-hard North Carolina team.
I guess, but I don't know if I would really classify Luke May as a tryhard. Like, I think Luke May in the past maybe we would have said that, but, you know, he's actually – and you wrote something about this, Sam, so you should know.
He's really good.
Luke's actually, like, really good. Like, that's one of the most surprising things of the season is that Luke May is, like, okay, legitimately, like, an All-American basketball player. Who saw that coming?
Yeah, if you were making an All-American team right now, you could not – like, if you're making three teams, you couldn't leave Luke May off of them.
He has to be on one of them, man. Yes. I mean, North Carolina, they deserve to be ranked in the top 10, and Luke May is basically averaging, what, like 20 and 10, 19 yeah. and 11 or something like that?
Yep, that's about right. But, like, even beyond him, like, Theo Pinson, I know he has, like, a five-star reputation, but, you know, he's never lived up to that, and he's, like, a try-hard defensive stopper now. Garrison Brooks, what is he? But just a guy who is, you know, a guy battling inside and trying to fight for position. Same with Sterling Manley when he gets off the bench. And Kenny Williams is a gunner, a three-point shooter, but he gives a ton of effort defensively. Like, Jaleek Felton is kind of their super athletic, like, guy that Tennessee doesn't have to me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, when I look at this North Carolina team, I don't know that there are any NBA players on it, like, other than maybe Felton.
Yeah, I guess. I think Joel Bear will get a cup of coffee.
Maybe. I mean, like, put it this way. I just did a thing on seniors in the NBA. And I started by doing like 20 dudes and then ended up cutting it to like 7 or 8 or 9 or something. And I wrote about Barry and before deleting it. And what I said about Barry is like, yeah, he has a couple of like NBA execs who kind of think he could be an NBA backup point guard. But then you look at this point guard class and you think like, okay, there's no way he can be below or no way he can be ahead of like Landry Shamet. There's no way he can be ahead of Jalen Adams. Jalen Adams is just a better player than he is. Like there's no way he can be ahead of X, Y, and Z, Devontae Graham,
Trae Young,
Javon Carter, even like Javon Carter is a better NBA prospect than he is because of the defense. So like what does Joel Berry do on an NBA level? I don't really know, but, at the end of the day, I would lean toward, he does like, he might get like a couple games, but he's not an NBA player. And like Theo Pinson, probably not an NBA player. I mean, Luke May, who I'm done doubting Luke May at this stage, I guess is the way to put it. So like, I don't know if this North Carolina team has like any NBA players on it.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I don't know if Tennessee does, but if you guys are going to be doing anything on Sunday, maybe like you're an Eagles fan and you're kind of mad because they just lost Carson Wentz, or your fantasy team sucks and you're out of the playoffs, watch this game because Tennessee's got a kid named Grant Williams who's good, who's underrated, and who people don't really know about. Let's move on though, Sam. Saturday afternoon, we have number 25 Cincinnati going into UCLA, and Cincinnati, according to KenPom, is favored by 3 points. Who do you like there?
Yeah, I'll be at this game. Cincinnati was one of my like Final Four dark horses coming into the year. And, you know, they lose to Xavier and Florida in their first two really, really tough games of the year. I'm going to go Cincinnati. I just don't think that other than Baylor this year, or no, they didn't play Baylor. They played Wisconsin in that Hall of Fame tip-off tournament.
They lost really, to Creighton.
Yeah, they haven't really played like an awesome defense this year. You know, Michigan got to them a little bit. I think that they scored like 70 points on 78 possessions or something like that. You know, the Georgia Tech game was a weird one because it was in China, but they're a good defensive team. And, you know, UCLA didn't necessarily respond well to that. So I think Cincinnati keeps this relatively low scoring in terms of the Bruins. And I think Cincinnati wins by, let's say, 3 possessions, so at least 7.
I am kind of with you there. I also think that another point that you got to make is that the weakness with the Cincinnati team is at the point, right? Like we don't really know who the best point guard is for them, what the best situation for them is at the point.
Sure.
And I don't think that UCLA is the kind of – like. So if you have a situation where you don't know who's going to be a great point guard for your team or how you're going to run offense or who's going to create, and you're going up against a team that doesn't really play defense – so it doesn't really matter if your point guard maybe is not great off the bounce or maybe is a little bit turnover prone or whatever. So I don't think that UCLA is the kind of team that could take advantage of what Cincinnati doesn't do well. So I think that I'm with you there, although yeah. I don't know. 3 points is kind of a lot of points there for me.
Well, they've struggled a lot with like jitterbuggy like guards, right? Like Khyree Thomas had a really good game against them. He's a little bit more powerfully built, but he's quick enough to get into the paint. You know, Michigan's guards actually like kind of turned that game. Like Xavier Simpson defensively was huge in that game. You know, Eli Brooks was solid in that game, and that's one of the worst high major point guard battles right now in the country, in my opinion. And then if you go back to the Central Arkansas game, which is a game that was shockingly taken to overtime, Jordan Howard is one of the best mid-major guards in the country, 5'11 kid, really, really quick, and they really struggled to contain him at all in that game. So I would imagine that Kane Broome, Justin Jennifer, whichever Cincinnati guy ends up being the point, can take advantage of that a little bit, get into the paint, collapse the defense a little bit, and they have some shooters this year. They can play 5 out if they need to. I just think Cincinnati's better than they are, to be frank.
Yeah, I'm with you there. One real quick note that I think is interesting. Jaron Simmons, who is Michigan's third string point guard, was an all-conference player at Ohio, averaged 15 points and 7 assists there, decided to transfer out of the program as a grad transfer, went to Michigan, and in Michigan's last 5 games, he's played a total of 20 minutes. He's taken 2 DMPs, and I wonder if he regrets leaving Ohio and trying to go play in Michigan.
Yeah, I think he probably does. That whole point guard thing is weird right now. Well, I don't know what's going on with the Michigan schools right now between the Nick Ward deal and like the point guard competition, you know, thing at Michigan. It's a weird, weird scenario up there. I hate that state. I went to Ohio State. Screw that.
All right, so let's move on then. Oklahoma at Wichita State. KenPom is giving Wichita State favored by 9. So he's giving Oklahoma 9 points. What's your take there?
Oh, man. 9 is a lot.
That's a lot of points.
9 is a lot of points. I would bet this line will be a little bit lower whenever it comes out than 9. If it's 9, I will take Oklahoma. I do think Wichita State wins straight up, though.
Yeah, that 9 points is a lot of points.
9's a lot.
A lot of points. But here's my thing. So what is Oklahoma if they don't have Trae Young playing great, right? And have we seen Trae Young yet go up against a guy that is as big and is as long as Landry Shamet is? So I think that there's the chance that with Wichita State's defensive schemes and the fact that Greg Marshall is one of the best in the business at what he does, I think there's a chance that Wichita State can take Trae Young out of this game. And if they do, then I can see the potential for this kind of being a blowout. Has Oklahoma played a true road game yet? Let me look that up right now.
Oklahoma, well, yeah, they played in LA against USC last week.
That's right.
But
that wasn't a true road game. That was at the Staples Center. So this is the first time that Trae Young will be playing a true road game in college. And he's going into, is it Coke Arena, the Coke Center, Cook Center, whatever it is.
It's like
that place where they play angry in Wichita is not an easy place to play. So
can I just kind of give like a little bit of a hot take on that? Like,
I want all of the hot takes, Sam.
Like, I don't think like Wichita's defense has been the typical like crazy play angry style that they get credit for being, right? You look at Oklahoma State, almost dropped a point per game on them. San Diego State was really, really good against them offensively. A Baylor team that no one is really all that concerned about, offensively at least, dropped a point per game against them. Cal dropped a point per game against them. Like, this Wichita State defense, particularly without Marcus McDuffie, just kind of taking up a bunch of space with his length and his athleticism, is a little bit overrated right now, I think. And I'm someone who said I thought they would be the best defense coming into the year. And I don't think they've shown that yet.
Yeah, it's also worth noting South Dakota State put up 50 points on them in the first half. Such a bad performance that, I don't know if you saw this video, Greg Marshall stormed off the floor, pushed through his bench, and threw two players out of the way so he could get off the court that quickly because he was apparently not a fan. I do think that is a fair point to make, but I guess a home game against a team like Oklahoma that runs so much of their offense through a point guard who we have never really seen go up against somebody with quite as much length and size as Landry Shamet has. Plus the fact that I do think that in a one game sample, Greg Marshall can figure out a way to shut down a team where there's really one guy you got to worry about. So I don't know. It's just, I do think that's something that you have to take into consideration. And if it comes down to, let's say, like 5 or 6 points, and that's what the line actually is, I think I probably would take Wichita State there.
If it's 5, I would take Wichita State. At 9, I will take Oklahoma. You mentioned that like he hasn't really played anyone like Landry Shamet at 6'4" and long and rangy defensively. I mean, the closest guy he's probably faced to that is Jalen Barford from Arkansas, who's 6'3", has some length, can do some stuff. And they ended up losing that game by 8 or 9 points, if I remember correctly. So, I think there are a lot of reasons for you to be on the Wichita side here, especially if it is down around 5 or 6. But nine's a lot. If it's 9, I'm taking Oklahoma and just taking the points and seeing where it goes.
All right. Virginia Tech is at number 8, Kentucky. Kentucky is favored by 6 points, according to KenPom. And Virginia Tech, believe it or not, is one of the best offenses and most explosive offenses in college basketball. Who do you like there, Sam?
Yeah, they have the best effective field goal percentage in the entire country right now. A lot of that comes from playing really, really bad teams. But also, you know, that they've they know how to score. They shoot the ever-loving hell out of the ball with guys like Nikhil Alexander-Walker, Justin Robinson, Ahmed Hill, Justin Bibbs. You know, they can go four out and really have no issue at all. So
just to elaborate on that, they have currently have four guys that are averaging more than 3 3-pointers attempted per game that shoot it better than 45.8% from three, which is pretty crazy if you think about it.
Yeah, it's pretty bonkers. Like them and Purdue might be the two best shooting teams in the country this year.
As a team, they shoot 46.8% from three. That's second nationally. Can you name actually who is the best 3-point shooting team in the country in terms of percentage?
There was a point where I could do this. Go ahead, tell me.
Evansville. And they are both at 46.8%. So more or less, Virginia Tech is the best 3-point shooting team in the country. Anyways, continue with what you were saying. I don't remember what it was.
Okay. So they're really good offensively. They can really shoot the basketball. That kind of creates a very interesting matchup dynamic against the Kentucky team, right? Kentucky's super long and rangy defensively, not a team that shoots the ball all that well from distance offensively. The key matchup to me here is going to be Chris Clark against Kevin Knox. I think whoever gets the best of that matchup kind of tells the tale of this game, right? Because if Kevin Knox can kind of get loose and go for 20 points and, you know, do the stuff that we've come to know and love from his game so far and why I think he's going to be a top 10 pick in the NBA draft in 2018. I think that Kentucky can do enough defensively to at least slow down that 3-point attack. You know, one of the things about, you know, John Calipari teams over the years was that they were good at limiting 3-pointers. So far, that hasn't really happened yet. I think that they're giving up 3-point attempts on 43% of their opponent's field goal attempts, which is 308th in the country. So if Virginia Tech gets loose for threes and starts knocking them down, as we know that they can do from this year, Virginia Tech probably wins this game outright. But if it's six, I'm going to ride Rupp. I'm going to go Kentucky and just kind of assume that their athleticism and size ends up winning out the day.
I'm really, really fascinated by this game, mostly because I don't think we actually know anything about either of these teams. Like Kentucky, they've been good so far, but the only thing they've actually done of note is lose by four to a Kansas team that just got whooped at home by Arizona State. Yeah. So we don't really know all that much about Kentucky. And then with Virginia Tech, like they've been pretty impressive too. And winning at Mississippi is a good win, right? Beating Iowa is a pretty good win. You know, they took care of Washington pretty easily, but they also got smacked around by St. Louis in New York. So, which by the way, is like one of the single weirdest results of the season so far, St. Louis beating Virginia Tech. So I'm mostly curious about this game because I don't know. I feel like I don't know anything about either of these two teams, and it's the perfect matchup, I think, to be able to figure out like just something about them. You know, you got this high-powered Virginia Tech offense going up against a team that should be able to slow them down defensively, whereas we all thought Kentucky was going to be built around their defense this year. So let's see how good it is against a team like Virginia Tech. I think I would probably lean towards, you know, if it's, I think, here's my thing. I think lines always get inflated in favor of Kentucky, right?
Yep.
Because you have so many people from, so many Kentucky fans that are going to be betting on Kentucky. So I generally think that like your best bet, if it's a Kentucky line, is to bet the other team because you're probably like, if you do that over the long run,
points.
I think that you're getting a couple extra points, and that's the way to do it in the long run. So I think I'd probably go Virginia Tech here.
So if you made me pick a winner to this game, I think I would say Kentucky, like maybe 55-60% of the time. I will stay away from betting this game. I can tell you that right now. Like I probably will not bet this game at all.
Honestly, yeah, that's probably the right answer.
Yeah, but I will say this, if it gets like the money line gets up to around like 185, 200 for Virginia Tech, that might be my favorite of everything that we've kind of talked about here. Just take the shot on getting 2-1 on your money with the Hokies, who we don't know enough about yet, but their matchup as a 3-point shooting team theoretically plays well into what we've seen from Kentucky so far.
Yeah, I agree with you there. All right, real quick, there are 6 more games that I just want to touch on really quick. We don't have to go deep into them, but we have the Crossroads Classic. Let's start with Butler against number 17 Purdue. KenPom is saying that Purdue's going to win by 7. Who do you like there, Sam?
I would probably take Purdue. I'm really high on Purdue this year. I think that they're going to battle for the Big Ten title, probably end up losing by like 2 or 3 games just because Michigan State's really good. But they're an awesome, awesome basketball team. They defend, they knock down threes, and they play small against a Butler team that doesn't really have a whole lot inside to be able to defend Isaac Haswith.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I like Purdue. Even though 7 is a lot of points in that matchup, I do think that Purdue kind of wins that one going away. The second of the Crossroads Classic, second half of the doubleheader. I can't talk today. What's going on with me, Sam? The second half of the doubleheader of the Crossroads Classic. There we go. That was hard. Is Notre Dame against Indiana. Notre Dame is favored by 9 points, according to KenPom. Sam, do you agree with Kenny there?
Yeah, I think 9 is about the number that I would put on this game, which means I'll probably stay away from it. If you look at what Indiana's done recently, they've actually battled relatively against some tough teams. They were within 10 against Duke, and that was tight going down to the last 6 or so minutes. Louisville was like a 9-8-point game, if I remember correctly. So, you know, they've battled, they've played tough. I think I probably lean Notre Dame here again if it's going to be 9, but, you know, again, I'll probably stay away from this, to be honest, just from what we've seen from both teams.
Yeah, if you were going to make me bet, I think I would probably take Indiana here. I think Archie has those guys playing hard. I think they are a little bit better defensively than they were early in the season. I think that he has them trending in the right direction. And frankly, I think they just kind of match up well with Notre, about as well as you can. Notre Dame is impossible to match up with because of the style that they play. But I think that Indiana has some guys that can at least make Bonzi Colson work for it. And if you can if you make Bonzi Colson work for it, then I think you got a shot against Notre Dame. All right. Syracuse at Georgetown at the
Syracuse. I don't care what the line is.
It's Syracuse -1. The undefeated Georgetown Hoyas, Sam. They're one of 5 undefeated teams left in the country.
I don't care what the line
is. They are currently, right now, if you had to take bets, they would be able to win the MEAC because I think they're like 7-0 against MEAC teams this year.
I've been keeping track of this. They are 4-0 against MEAC teams this year. They've beaten 3 in a row. Yes, Georgetown seriously scheduled 3 MEAC teams in a row. I can't handle that.
They are going to be probably 70% of the fans in the Verizon Center are going to end up being Syracuse fans, I would bet, on Saturday.
Yeah, I think that a big problem with Georgetown, and yes, I've actually watched 2 of their games this year because I'm a glutton for punishment. I think Syracuse is going to force turnovers against them. I think that from what I've seen from Georgetown, they've been a little bit undisciplined offensively, so I can see them struggling with the zone a little bit. You know, they've knocked down 3s, so maybe you could say they might bust the zone up a little bit, but they're not taking a ton of them. They're not really, you know, their ball movement's been okay, but it's nothing special right now. So I'm going to go with, I'm going to go with Syracuse here. I do think that, I mean, like I was making a joke about, like, you know, I don't care what the line is, but like, I don't think Syracuse is anything to write home about this year. You know, they have the win against Maryland, got their ass kicked against Kansas earlier this year, but I just think they're a better team. The one thing to watch for though is that they're getting a ton of their offense off of second chances, and Jesse Govan actually has been really good regardless of who Georgetown has played. He's eating rebounds this year, so if he can lock down the paint and lock down those second chance opportunities, maybe Georgetown can sneak a win. But I'm gonna go Syracuse and just assume that they're better.
You know way too much about this Georgetown team right now, so let's move on. Number 22, Florida, is playing Clemson in Florida. It's technically a neutral site game. Florida is favored by 4. Sam, who do you like?
Yeah, it's like a part of this same event with Florida State playing Oklahoma State, I believe. Clemson is a little bit feistier than what I think people have noticed this year. They played really tight against a really good Temple team. They beat the heck out of an Ohio State team that I also think is pretty good. they actually have a shot to make the NCAA tournament this year, I think. And I'm going to go with Florida just with it being a road game. This is a good Florida team, and we've seen them obviously be really fun offensively. Chris Chioza is really good. Jalen Hudson's really good. They knock down shots from deep. I think they're just a better team than Clemson, but this is going to be a really fun athletic game that I think is going to be enjoyable to watch at least.
I would take Florida here. I think that they win fairly easily. I think that they're going to figure out and solve the issues that they had. Maybe the best thing about this game is that they can finally get out of the O-Dome where they lost two games in a row.
Yeah.
Last one, Sam, Kansas, who was coming off of two straight losses, who just got worked over by Washington, who just got worked over by Arizona State in Fog Allen Fieldhouse, is now going on the road to Nebraska and Tim Miles, and they're favored by 9 points. Is Timmy Miles going to get this thing done?
I would love nothing more than Tim Miles getting this thing done. I will say this. Nebraska has been really good at home this year. They beat Boston College. They beat Minnesota. Have not yet lost in Pinnacle Bank Arena. So
I don't think people realize how good of a home court advantage you can have in that building.
Right. No, I 100% agree.
They pack that thing out. It gets loud. Nebraska fans. Nebraska as a state is a really underrated basketball state. Both Creighton and Nebraska are always going to be in the top 10 or 15 of attendance nationally every single year. They get 17,000 at whatever the building is that Creighton plays in. Gets like 17,000 a night. You get like 15,000 a night wherever, whatever the thing is at Nebraska. Pinnacle Bank, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I don't know. Are you on Nebraska here?
So I think Kansas wins, but I will take the points with Nebraska if you're giving me 9. The big reason for that is, if you watched the Washington game at all against Kansas, the one thing that Washington did was they just shut down the 3-point line, and then Kansas didn't really know what to do. Nebraska is one of the best teams in the country at limiting 3-point attempts. Actually, they are only allowing opponent 3-point attempts on 27.9% of their shot attempts. That's 7th in the country. So they're really, really good at doing the thing that Kansas absolutely has to do to get efficient offense. Now, maybe, Bill Self has made some adjustments over the course of the last week and tried to figure out a way to, mitigate how often they need the 3-point shot. But you wrote a really good piece earlier this week that said, you do worry about them being able to create their own shots. And I agree with you. I think that they really struggle to do that. So I think Kansas wins. I just think they're a little bit more talented, but I do think it's going to be tight down to like the last 5 minutes.
The single most surprising stat that I've seen this entire season. Do you know what it is? Do you know what I'm about to say?
I do, because I read your piece, but I'll actually kind of push back on this, but go ahead.
They are 349th in the country in free throw rate.
Yep.
That means that outside of two teams, for people that don't know what free throw rate is, it is free throws attempted divided by field goals attempted. For every free throw that Kansas takes, they have to take 5 field goals. So that's the third lowest rate in all of college basketball.
So yeah, like the thing that you and I talked offline before the year about like how high we both are on Devontae Graham. You're a little bit higher on him than I am, for instance. The thing that I said was that I don't know if he can consistently get into the teeth of the defense. And this is a number that kind of shows that, you know what I mean? Malik Newman's a perimeter player. Svi is a perimeter player. Vic and, to an extent, Graham are really their only two threats to knock down, to attack closeouts and get into the lane, or use screens and get into the lane. Udoka Azubuike is drawing fouls at a relatively high rate, but do you want him at the foul line even? Like, does he help you at the foul line? When I look at this team, I just don't know what they can do offensively when they're not shooting threes is the big thing. And I'm not really surprised about that, given what the talent was that they had coming into the year.
I thought that Graham would be a little bit better at being able to create off the dribble than he has been. I think that some of his issues have been the direct result of the fact that teams kind of know what's coming with Kansas a little bit, I guess. But yeah, it is worrisome. And it's also worrisome that he is literally the only person on that roster that can create something for himself. Everything, everyone else on that roster is a finisher, whether it's Svi's finishing a kickout or attacking a closeout. Same thing with the Gerald Vick, or maybe he's catching a lob. Udoka Azubuki, whether he's at the rim catching a lob, he's not really a guy you just throw the ball to on the block and say, okay, go get a bucket or go get fouled. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. They don't really have anyone that can create. So,
like, the guy it was supposed to be was Malik Newman, and he's not creating at all. Like, he's just a guy that stands on the perimeter. He knocks down threes. He doesn't use his dribble to go forward. He uses his dribble to create space backward. And that's not what Kansas needs right now.
Yep. Yep. All right, Sam, I kept you here long enough, man. I do appreciate you coming and hanging out with me for about twice as long as I thought I was going to have you here. Hopefully we are going to make some money this weekend. Why don't you tell people all about the Game Theory Podcast and where they can find you?
Go subscribe to the Game Theory Podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, whatever, you know, app you use. Go subscribe to The Athletic. That's where I write. That's where you can find my work. Yeah, I think that that's about all I got for you.
And then rate it and review it in those apps. As I said earlier, when you rate these podcasts and you review these podcasts and you have interactions with these podcasts within these apps, it's really good for the metrics. It helps us show up higher on lists. It makes our bosses happy. And when our bosses are happy, we're happy. And when we're happy, you are getting a better product. So really, you're just doing it for yourself. Sam, I appreciate the time.
Yep, anytime, Rob.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.